Total revenue combined of all those startups is over 300 million. The total value of all the deals closed, I believe, is over 100 million.
Hi, welcome to the Founders with Pet podcast, where I interview amazing entrepreneurs from diverse backgrounds about their journeys, successes, failures, and lessons along the way. Welcome to the Founders with Peck podcast, where we interview amazing founders, non-traditional founders, and just try to cover a lot of bases. And on today's show, I have Andrew Gazdecki. I've actually known about one of his earlier companies, Business Apps, because I tried to compete in a very similar space, but failed spectacularly. But I'd love to have him talk about that journey as well as his new startup, MicroAcquire. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. So tell us some stats for MicroAcquire right now.
Stats for MicroAcquire. So in terms of buyers, I believe we just passed 60,000 registered buyers. I'd have to double check, but every day we're seeing between 300 to 500 new signups. And then out of that, 80% are buyers, around 20% are founders looking to sell. Currently on the platform, there's about 600 startups live. Total revenue combined of all those startups is over 300 million. A total value of all the deals closed, I believe, is over 100 million. And I say I believe because I don't have like full visibility into what gets a lot of people go outside of the platform and transact, which makes total sense.
And I also try
to respect everyone's privacy as much as possible. So sometimes today I found out about a deal that was a little north of $500,000. Just someone emailed me saying like, hey, I bought this for $500,000. I look in the marketplace, it's still like active. So I take down the listing and confirm with the seller. So yeah, long story short, things are kind of booming. So it's been.
I have this bad habit of jumping right in, but for people who've never heard of MicroAcquire, what is MicroAcquire?
Yeah, the simple one-liner, it's a startup acquisition marketplace. So just think of a marketplace like Zillow, but instead of houses, it's startups. And these startups range from SaaS companies to e-commerce to even some interesting companies like crypto companies. There's been a couple like NFT platforms, mobile apps, any type of small tech company, typically profitable, you'd see on MicroAcquire.
Yeah. And this, you touched on a subject where, you know, people can go around your platform. Do you have visions where it's a little bit more hands-on, where they have to transact on the platform eventually?
I think eventually that's where I'd like to take the platform. Because right now, when you think about it, MicroAcquire at its core, our main function is we connect buyers and sellers. So everything else happens outside of the platform. So use a third-party escrow system. You go and you find an attorney somewhere else. You go and find an M&A advisor if your deal size supports that. You use Google Drive for a data room. You do like the transition of the assets with just like a Google Doc where you share path. Everything's super manual and like it feels super legacy in terms of the software. So having all of that on the marketplace is kind of my long-term goal. I have no idea how long it's going to take to build all that stuff, but yeah, like, so you can actually find a startup, message the founder, you know, be able to put money into escrow, everything end to end. That's kind of the long-term aspiration of MicroAcquire.
Well, as an MVP, I think you have a very successful MVP, and I know you tend to tweet some stats too. You know, this is a subscription model. What's the ARR, MRR right now?
So annual recurring revenue, we just passed 510,000. So the only business model is we charge buyers a small yearly subscription to access deals on the platform. And so for founders, it's completely free. There's no fees, there's no commissions, there's no cost to list. It's 100% free. And that was the original idea behind MicroAcquire. It was going to be this free platform. I was going to run it for a period of time to just because I thought it was the coolest thing to do. That's really how it started. I just thought it needed to exist. So I built it and I did run it for free, entirely for free for about 11 months. And then around the 11th month mark, a couple sellers complained to me about too many people reaching out to their startup. And the original vision behind MicroAcquire was to be a really vetted marketplace where every buyer is vetted, every startup is still vetted. But the buyers started signing up so fast, I just couldn't click manually approve all day. So I just let everyone, it was a free-for-all for a little bit. Right. And that's where the premium buyer came in. So now you have to subscribe to contact sellers. So that's how I landed on that business model, if anyone's wondering.
Yeah, you created some friction for the bigger side of the marketplace that was just bombarding the more exclusive side of the marketplace.
Exactly.
Yeah, great, great idea. I understand that this is a pretty lean team. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so right now I am the only full-time. Actually, no, on Monday I had my CFO from Business App start. He's going to be COO of the company. So we're really, you know, we're ramping up. So, but before that, it was just me, contractors, a very lean operation. It's a pretty easy business to run, but I will say for a little bit, I was working like 4 a.m. to like 10 a.m. It wasn't healthy. And this was like a customer support. I was taking every startup live, like where I'd get the information and proof the profiles as much as I can, write the newsletters, schedule the social media posts, and then still do my personal tweets and personal, and then do podcasts like that. You can only do that if you love what it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. So it wasn't like 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. Oh my gosh, this is horrible. It was like, this is awesome. But now I have people helping on customer support. What else? Freelance content writer, and then contract engineers and designers, but just me and COO currently.
Yeah, and you're also doing a podcast and talking about some of the startups, right?
Yeah, so I've had two podcasts. I haven't been consistent with them because what happens is like I have free time and then the business just booms and I have to go, like I just don't have time to like, you know, bring guests on, you know, and I don't want to, you know, be all stressed out and stuff like when I'm like on a podcast with someone, especially if they're a guest. But originally I had a podcast called Zero to a Million, which I thought was a fun podcast. And I just interviewed SaaS founders. And the purpose of the podcast was just talking about like, how did you go from $0 to your first million? And I had some pretty cool guests on there. I had like Neil Patel, I had David Cancel, founder of Drift, founder of Salesloft, founder of Sendoso. Just some people I admire and respect, and just hearing their stories was awesome. And then most recently I've been starting a podcast. I think I'm going to call it like SaaS Acquisitions or something like that. I literally just did it off the cuff, and I've been interviewing people that have acquired businesses on MicroAcquire.
Yeah, I think that's a great, or even people who sell business, either one, I think would make great stories.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't gotten someone scheduled yet to sell, but that's definitely in the works.
Cool. Tell us a little bit about your background. Who's Andrew? Where'd you grow up? What'd you study?
Yeah, I was originally born in Detroit, and I lived there till I was about 3. And then my parents moved to Southern California. So I grew up in a small beach town in Southern California called San Clemente. And that was awesome, right on the beach, grew up surfing, skateboarding a lot. If you search my name on YouTube, there's a funny video where I did a skateboard petition when I was like 12 or something like that, or 11, I don't know. Check it out. There's like 3 different news stations. Tony Hawk like mailed me a bunch of stuff. It was my 15 minutes of fame. Went to CSU Chico State. I majored in business marketing. I graduated with what I believe to be the lowest GPA in school. I graduated with a 2.07. So if I got a B in a class, but I got a B minus, that would go below a 2.0, and you don't get a degree if you get below a 2.0. I don't know if I'm proud of that or embarrassed, but That's fact. Graduated 2.07, but I knew school was never my thing. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur very early on. I started a number of businesses in high school. And when I say businesses, I mean like eBay store. I kind of grew up on eBay. So shout out to eBay. What else? I had like an affiliate website for a really popular game where we sold like gold that was used inside the game. It was World of Warcraft.
Yeah. I knew people who did that.
It's so embarrassing, but it actually was really lucrative.
Did you do the mining yourself or?
No. So I was an affiliate to a company that did the mining. And my only role in that was I learned how to build websites on like GeoCities and then slowly moved to Dreamweaver. And I was kind of okay with Photoshop. So I just basically put together a website that was an affiliate to the gold that they were selling. And so I would just market it. And I just had a pay-per-click account. So I learned Google Ads. This was like freshman year in college or something like this. So I was 18. But I made a lot of money. I made like $5,000 one month. And this was during summer. And I had a job at Sears. So I quit that job. And I thought I was doing the math. I was like, if this keeps, I'm going to be rich in college. And then what ended up happening was the Google terms went from like 50 cents to like $20 a click. So the business model went upside down. And that was probably the biggest heartbreak ever because it was all on autopilot. I barely had to do anything. Oh. Yeah, I did stuff like that. And then I started a number of different other businesses after that, just, you know, mostly for fun to learn. And then probably the business that was probably the most meaningful was a business called Phone Freelancer, which was a job board that connected with businesses and mobile developers. And that is what led me to Business Apps, the company that you had previously heard about, because I'd see people making these job posts of, hey, I'm a restaurant. I want a mobile app that does these five things. And I saw them paying like $50,000 to sometimes like $75,000 for just these very simple iPhone apps. This was before Android too, I should note. So very early when the iPhone was released. So I sold that and used that as seed capital for Business Apps. And then am I going too far?
No, with
the career? Okay, I'll keep going. And then, yeah, I ran Business Apps for about 8 years. I sold that to a
private that was kind of bootstrap. Based on your other funds?
Yeah. So not, I like to say it's bootstrap, but I've heard some people say like, no, it wasn't. We raised 110,000, originally raised 50,000 to start. And then we had another angel investor come in and invested 60,000. But the business was like, we went from, I believe, 0 to 4 million in the first 3 years or something like that. It was just a right place, right time. I call it like an obvious problem in an obvious market with an obvious solution business. Like the iPhone just came out. Every business was trying to figure out how to
make an iPhone.
Yeah. You know, those opportunities don't come along very often. It got pretty lucky there. So yeah, only raised about 100,000, turned down a lot of offers to raise venture capital, did the whole met with every VC firm possibly you can imagine out here in the Bay, because I founded it in Chico in college. And then we moved the company to Millbrae. If anyone knows where Millbrae is, it's like the first, if you ever go to SFO and you go to In-N-Out, you're in Millbrae. It's like that's the main landmark, but there's an office right across from that In-N-Out. And that's where we had our first Bay Area office. And it literally has office space available painted on the building, which means it's like the lowest quality office ever. It had like ashtrays in the hallway. Like it was just like the guy bought it and just never redid it. It was month to month. We ended up having four different offices in that office. We had an office for the support team, sales team on the bottom floor, and then we rented a specific snack room. And then we expanded the support team office further out. Like we just started renting every office they had in the building because it was so cheap and we were growing so fast. And then we moved to San Francisco at an office on California and Van Ness, which was pretty cool. because I was like 23, 24 at the time. So right in the heart of San Francisco, those were some of the best years of my life. Amazing team. And then actually moved the company out of San Francisco to San Diego to reposition it more towards an acquisition. And once that happened, back up to the Bay and in San Mateo.
How'd you acquire customers for business apps?
So we had originally we thought we were going to cold call our way to, I eventually got the business to about 10 million in revenue. And yeah, the original idea was we're going to cold call these small businesses all day and it's going to be amazing. And if you've ever cold called small businesses, it's not amazing and it's not easy.
We tried that and it didn't work.
Yeah. The key, if you're selling to small businesses, you have to speak to the owner. You'll notice a lot of SMB focused companies raise a lot of money. And that's because they usually build in-person sales teams. So it's a very relationship based sale, like most sales, but more so with small businesses. So you have to go into the business. You have to meet with them. There's a saying where small businesses lack time, aptitude, and money, which is like the perfect storm. So they don't have any time to learn about your solution. They don't have any money to pay for it. And they don't have the aptitude to, like, they just don't care. Like, yep. You know, business is business. So introducing a new tech solution is very difficult for SMB. But so what we did was had a white label reseller program where we partnered with web design agencies that had these existing relationships with small businesses. So an example would be, you know, San Diego Web Design made websites for 20 clients in San Diego. We would partner with them and then they would take our app building technology and we'd put their logo on it. And by putting their logo and removing any association with business apps, that would allow them to charge whatever they wanted. So they could charge almost like a semi-custom app price. So we would charge them around like $30 to $40 a month per app created. They would turn around and then build apps for their clients with a $1,000 setup fee and they would manage it for like $100 a month. So the margins were pretty good on that. And then, yeah, ended up partnering with companies in 40, 50 different countries. We translated the product and more languages than I can count. And yeah, we made more mobile apps than any other company in the world. At one point, from what we could tell, if Apple's numbers were reliable and our numbers were reliable, Apple would release numbers on how many apps were approved into the App Store every quarter or month. I can't remember which. And we do simple division, like, okay, we submitted this many apps, this many.
Do you submit the apps or do the agency submit the apps?
That's a great question. We would submit the apps. And that was not fun. Have you ever submitted an iPhone app?
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes like 45 minutes. So we eventually automated this process where we could upload thousands of apps like in 2 days. But before that, like in Millbrae, we literally had a team of like 8 people who would just upload apps all day. It was the most monotonous job, but we had to do it. And we were young and I guess willing to kind of go through that sort of pain. But yeah, we would literally just sit there, take screenshots of like the iPhone 4, iPhone 5. When the iPhone 5 came out, that was horrendous because we had to like adjust our software to basically have the ability to upload iPhone 5 screenshots. And we had to scramble every
right,
time.
4 and 5 were slightly one. Yeah, 5 was longer, right?
Yeah. So you could not submit apps unless it was compatible on the 5 or it had the black bars at the bottom and the top.
Yeah.
So we went through all those changes and worked with Apple on all that stuff. But yeah, we uploaded a lot of apps manually and then eventually automated it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you scaled it. You had a good strategy on scaling via partners and the white label and then translate. Oh, did you ever run into problems? I know that Apple at one point cracked down on companies, app submission companies that had essentially the same app, you know, reskinned several times over. Was that ever a problem?
Yeah. So I've only told this story a couple times because it's so crazy. I don't even know if people will believe me when I say this, but yeah. So you're talking about the 4.2.6 templated app rejection rule. Mm-hmm. And when that hit, that kind of shook the industry up quite a bit. Basically what it meant is any app created with a template, regardless of the quality or the functionality or the look, just if it's created with a template. So you could have a beautiful app, award-winning quality, but just the mere fact that it was created with a template, it would get an instant rejection. It wouldn't even get a review. It would just go interview, rejected. And so we had spoken with Apple about this, and given we were, I believe, the biggest publisher at that time, we escalated the issue to some of the senior app reviewers at Apple. And we worked with them on a number of different things. And there's a story in TechCrunch. I leaked that. Yeah, I leaked that to Sarah Perez at TechCrunch because it was ridiculous. We would ask questions like, okay, so if we built this app custom, but it's going to look exactly the same, you'll approve it? Like you won't even be able to tell the difference. And they're like, yeah. And we're like, does that make any sense? And they're like, I'm sorry. So we started a petition, but really the turning point in that whole issue was we had an app that was featured on the Megyn Kelly show. Megyn Kelly, TV host that she hosted like the presidential debates. I don't know too much about her, but she has a big, big, big audience. I think she got into some trouble recently, so she no longer has a show. Said something that I don't know. But anyways, we found a segment with her, and this segment's still on YouTube somewhere, but we found a segment where she was interviewing these children that were, or teenagers that were using an app that was built on our platform to help prevent teen suicide. And these teenagers were talking about how this app was helping them, like, you know, prevent something serious. And so I literally emailed T. Cook at apple.com like 9 p.m. on a Saturday. And I just said like, hey, Sam, like, according to your new guidelines, apps like this aren't suitable for the App Store. You should check this out. I can't remember exactly what I said, but the story goes, I had the creepy email software where I could see where the email is being opened. And I see it being opened in like Berkeley, Cupertino. And this is like 9 o'clock at night on a Saturday. So I'm like, whoa, what's going on? I assume he forwarded it to someone I have no idea. But then Phil Schiller responds to me at 10:30 at night. And basically we went back and forth and we had some conversations, and that the rejection rule was tweaked where they removed it completely to where you can now upload apps used with the template. They just have to be uploaded into a unique developer account. So I don't know if that was like, I kind of came at them with like, hey, I'm going hard with the press. Like, you know, they're like, this is bad. Like, you're basically preventing small businesses from being able to create an app, because if they can't use a piece of software that speeds up the development, it's like they'll never be able to
develop. It's out of the price range, you know. Like, yeah, we build apps and design apps for a living, and we can't do it for the price that, you know, a small business would pay, right, without software. Exactly. So yeah, we totally shut them out.
And that was the argument I made. And I think they kind of saw the writing on the wall with the first TechCrunch article to come out and other companies like ChowNow. I was talking with the CEO of ChowNow for a bit. They actually lobbied with Congress. So, you know, it wasn't looking good. It was looking like, okay, Apple, you're purposely shutting out small businesses. Cause like you said, without a template, you know, like the guidelines should have been, hey, let's focus on raising the bar of quality, which we were all for, but it all worked out. But yeah, it was interesting. But that was probably like, I could tell you like 3 or 4 other times where Apple did some crazy stuff. We had a love-hate relationship with Apple.
but to your resourcefulness, you kind of went straight to the top and got the T. Cook email, and you know, yeah, you fought your battles and conquered them. And I see like a recurring pattern of resourcefulness, you know, in your stories. So I think that's the takeaway here.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I mean, it's kind of like a Hail Mary. It's like, why not? I heard he checked the email. So yeah, it worked out.
Also, you know, you're just kind of as a third party, kind of outside observer looking at your activities at MicroAcquire, you've always been, you know, kind of you studied marketing and you know, kind of you picked up Google Ads and stuff very early on. And that's one thing that I think one of my regrets is I wish I'd picked those skills up much earlier, you know, as a designer entrepreneur who always kind of sucked at marketing. I wish I had some of your marketing skills. What are some of the things that you do, you know, for example, for MicroAcquire that's been working?
So there's three kind of buckets that I think about marketing. There's paid media, earned media, and then owned media. So earned media would be like this, a podcast that I go on, or a press article, or a story about someone buying or selling something on MicroAcquire. So that's more just like brand. Owned media would be blog posts, videos that I create, or, you know, a podcast, you know, content that I am creating. And then paid media like Facebook ads, that's the smallest bucket. So just kind of having like a strategy for each of those. But I think the main thing is just having like, it's what I've learned over the years, it's so easy to market to customers that you really enjoy working with. Like if you're a salesperson, you're probably going to be really good at selling to other salespeople because you understand them. That's kind of your, and so for me, I think I can relate to most entrepreneurs, not ones that are running public companies or anything like that. But those are the people I admire and the people I respect and the people I genuinely want to help succeed with whatever that means to them. And if I can, great. So I'd say that's the key. That's probably like a cop-out answer to your question. But I think when you have passion for what you're doing, I've heard people say it doesn't matter. But in my opinion, it does. I love marketing MicroAcquire because I get to do like super funny stuff and I get to, you know, you create memes like on like entrepreneurship or just like startup ideas. So I think that gives you a competitive advantage when you market, because great marketing is about really standing out. You know, a lot of the marketing tactics that people do that worked, say, 2 years ago, that's kind of part of the playbook. It just aren't as effective anymore. People become almost desensitized to certain marketing styles or campaigns. So you always want to try to be as unique as possible. And I think when you're able to, you know, really, really, really understand the customer that you're trying to market to, the better your marketing is going to be. Things that have worked for me in MicroAcquire, again, we're kind of doing everything, but that's really only possible because I want to write about certain stuff. I love doing podcasts. I love talking to other entrepreneurs. I love, you know, just chatting it up with you. I love hearing about stories of entrepreneurs selling or buying a business. So I'm sure someone would debate me on that, but that's what I've found.
Yeah, there is. And I've heard that many times where there's activities that kind of give energy and drain energy, right? And if you enjoy working with entrepreneurs, it doesn't, like Naval Ravikant says, do stuff that looks like work to other people, right? But it feels like play to you. And if you enjoy this stuff, you know, you can outcompete. And the fact that you also mentioned that you like working with entrepreneurs, you know, then it's easy to market to. Plus you're one and you can relate to them. So, you know, you're one, you're the customer, and you enjoy working with them and talking to them, you know, and which is why, you know, relating to your story where you said, yeah, you'd work till like 4 a.m. or 10 a.m. And if you didn't like what you're doing or if you didn't like the customer, I doubt you'd do that, right?
No, it's absolutely impossible. And that's where I see a lot of entrepreneurs kind of getting tripped up, is they make a product and then they realize now it's time to market or sell that product. And sometimes, most of the times in the early days, it's a grind because you don't know it works. So you have to try a bunch of stuff. And then when something starts working, you know, you got to kind of get enough altitude underneath before you can really afford to hire people. So there is a period of like a valley of death where it's like, you just got to push through it. I was reading a stat the other day. I don't know the exact percentage, but burnout's one of the top reasons for startups failing. So being able to keep things fun and enjoyable is paramount. I mean, there's no way I would work 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. To me, it's like playing a game. Someone was asking me the other day, like, what hobbies do you have? And startups are kind of my biggest hobby. Yeah, I always say, like, when people are playing tennis on the weekend, I'm kind of playing startup. So when something's that fun, you know, it's really hard to compete with a founder that like really, really enjoys what they're doing. Like I would say, like if you would do it for free, you're probably onto something.
Yeah. If it's your hobby, your play, and it's somebody else's grind, then you're going to out-compete them all day long.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Were there any kind of valleys of death during business apps?
Business apps honestly was just a big learning experience. The company was successful because we were in such a big market. We made so many mistakes. Like I had the biggest mistake that comes to mind that kind of gives me chills now is we had $100,000 pay-per-click budget and it was returning 10,000 in customers. This was at a point when everything was, we call it the period of blowing up a Ferrari every single month, which would have been much better marketing than spending 100,000. Everything was just working. Like we were just growing like crazy. So we were in this situation of like, none of us are like, you know, traditional experienced marketers. We don't know what's working, so don't touch anything. And then when we finally hired someone to kind of analyze, like do attribution on like, okay, these leads are coming from here. How are they converting? Yeah, spent about $1 million on that, which, and I have tons of other like, we built like a CRM that we ended up shutting down. We built a do-it-yourself website builder that we ended up shutting down. Just first-time founder stuff where it's like features, more product. And then, you know, at the end, we were very, very focused and we trying to layer on additional complexity to the business. But in terms of like a really hard time, I would say probably the very beginning. Like the very beginning, there was a period of time I remember I had a few friends that were originally cold calling with me. And this was over winter break. And this is when I just won the business plan competition. I was 21 and I recruited three friends in college to cold call with me for the idea was, hey, we're going to cold call over winter break. It's going to be 3 months. It's going to be awesome. If we make 100 calls a day, we'll get like three clients a day. And that math works out. We didn't get any customers and school started again. Everyone started leaving. And I remember for a period of probably like 4 to 6 months, I was the only person working on business apps. And I'd go into this little office that we had. This was in Chico, an office. This was like $300. So it was like a WeWork. But that was tough. I mean, I didn't know what we were going to do because I knew I couldn't cold call my way to like that was sort of like, and I had no sales experience. I don't have a technical background. So there wasn't, it was just pure hustle and luck. And the reseller model I told you about actually came from, we were really fortunate to where we got some early press in like TechCrunch, Business Insider, New York Times. We had a good story, college kids helping small businesses build mobile apps. So that was really awesome to get some inbound traffic. And a guy in Switzerland built some apps for these really nice Ramada hotels. And I just wanted to talk to him, reached out. Long story short, he told me that I thought he owned the hotels, but he was making the apps on behalf of the hotels as a marketing partner. And he said, and like I could barely understand him because English wasn't his first language, but he just said white label. And I remember going on Wikipedia and looking up white label and it was like, remove your branding. And I said, if you can, you know, increase your subscription from like $100 a month to $2,000 a month, I'll have the money to build that functionality so you can white label it. And that's when the business just exploded after that. So I didn't even think of that model. It was just talking to customers and getting lucky again.
Yeah, it all comes down to kind of exploring that and having enough runway to do that and having enough grit to persevere through the dark times, because you could have, at any point when you were left alone doing the cold calls, you know, those are the times that are really easy to give up.
Yeah. When it gets like lonely and you don't really you don't know how to push the business forward, but you know, I was naive and sometimes being naive is a good thing. Or I was 21, I had a startup. So I was kind of happy the whole time. I was like, I don't care. Like I'm going to make it work. But yeah, that's one that comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned lots of, you know, trying a lot of things at business apps. How do you think about product and features now at MicroAcquire?
I try to build as literally only, I guess, put another way, with MicroAcquire, the features that we build are ones that are pretty obvious. They've been requested over and over and over and over. So at Business Apps, we built a lot of features that we just thought were cool. We didn't do a lot of research. Like, we kind of were like, this is going to be the next big thing. But really what you want to do is you want to talk to your customers as much as possible. So the roadmap that I have kind of in place is fairly, like, this has been request, like, I have a high degree of certainty that this is going to make a lot of people happy. And it's really about just prioritization in terms of what features should come first. But I would say just being really tuned in with your customers is key. And at Business Apps, I can't say I was that tuned in, because I was more focused on, like, I think this would be amazing. And in reality, that's the worst way to do product development. But I was young and, you know, I was like, I could be Steve Jobs and I could make this really cool iPhone feature. Some of it was cool, but most of it led to product or technical debt, and you got to support the functionality. So I guess when you build a lot of features and you have to maintain a lot of features, it puts a little scar tissue into you. So I guess now when I think of building new features, I always remember that when you build that feature, you got to maintain that feature and you got to keep that feature. So it goes through a little more rigorous thought process than it would before, I guess.
Taking the conversation maybe into MicroAcquire, you've seen a lot of startups. So you probably see a lot, have some pattern recognition. What are some pretty common businesses that get listed? And then for those people who are thinking of maybe listing their business, what are generally things that do well? What are buyers looking for? Are you seeing any trends, patterns?
Yeah, good question. I see a lot of interesting companies, lots of niches. Like, there was a marketing automation platform specifically for dentists that we listed the other day. I thought that was really cool. Just very specific niche. I think the takeaway there is there's a lot of money to be made or a lot of success to be had in small niches where you're not going to be a $1 billion company, but like you could build like a really, really nice, you know, 8-figure business in a certain market that no one's really looking at. I see a lot, you know, similar businesses, but really niche to certain verticals, which I think is really cool. I see a lot of different e-commerce companies, direct-to-consumer, kind of a little bit of everything. So in terms of trends, it's hard to really think of one off the top of my head. I see a lot of people using the GPT-3 technology. I don't know if that's the exact term, GPT-3, the text
generation. Yeah.
Yeah, lots of that. Been seeing a lot of stuff with NFTs. I think those are trends everyone's seeing. But in terms of the businesses that do well, the first thing is having just a good business in general. So a business that has happy customers, ideally is profitable. The product is good, like just the basics. Like, and then when they talk to buyers, they're prepared. They have some sort of, you know, overview of their financials. They're responsive. They take calls with sellers, they take calls with buyers just to show buyers that they're serious about selling their business instead of just kind of sitting back, hoping a buyer will just email them like a letter of intent randomly without talking to them. So those are the main things. It's really, it's nothing. It can be as complex or as simple as you want it to be, but really just the basics is what I probably see the most working, is having a good business, being very transparent with what your business is, being responsive, having adequate materials, answering questions in a timely manner, and just being a good person that's easy to deal with are all things that work out really well for sellers.
What's next for MicroAcquire?
I have some cool features I'm really excited about. One is like a letter of intent feature. That's where you can sell or send and receive. So if you were selling a company on MicroAcquire, I could send you a letter of intent. You can approve or deny that letter of intent. And that kind of like puts the deal in like under offer. That one is taking a lot of work. I'm also building a M&A advisor directory. So if you're a founder and you're selling maybe like a multi-million dollar company, probably makes sense to bring in an advisor just to make sure that, you know, this life-changing acquisition goes, you maximize this opportunity. So building out kind of like an Upwork style directory for both M&A advisors And for people who don't know what M&A advisor is, it's basically a fancy term for person who's helped a lot of companies get acquired. And then also for legal counsel as well. So thinking about stuff like that, like all the stuff people do outside of MicroCore, how do I bring more of that into the platform to make it, to just build more trust between buyers and sellers? So
yeah, more ancillary services that are kind of needed.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for this podcast. I've learned a lot, and thank you for sharing the MicroCore journey. If for those of you who are not following you on Twitter, because it seems like you pretty much, if you check Andrew's Twitter status, you know what's going on.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest way to know about MicroCore. Just follow me on Twitter at @agazdecky.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Founders with Peck. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel. If you leave us a review, I'll be sure to shout it out. And if you have any questions, you can tweet me on Twitter.